Public Health Committee to order at this time at 1:30. I'm Senator Bette Davis. I'm chairing. One of the first things I'd like to do, if you have cell phones, I'd like for you to cut them off. And we are having a joint meeting, but there's one piece of legislation that we're going to kick up prior to having the reports. But at this time, I'm going to say who's present from the Senate side, and I'll let the chair from the House side give his members. We have present with us Senator Egan and Senator Ellis and Senator Dyson from the Senate.
And from the House side, we have Representative Millett and myself, Representative Keller. And I expect there'll be more shortly.
At this time, I'd like to call up the sponsor of Senate Bill 144. That's the piece of legislation we're going to take up prior to going to the reports. If you want to give an explanation, we do have the, everybody have a copy of the fiscal note, and that was the reason the bill was not passed out at the last meeting, and I would like to do that at this meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent District P in Anchorage. The bill before us is Senate Bill 144. I want to first of all thank you for waiving the rule and hearing the fiscal note today. I know that you share my concern and Senator Olson's concern that this is a critically important bill. The fiscal note has been prepared by the Department of Health and Human Services. And Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I would like to have Dr. Hurlburt and his assistants present that fiscal note. Would that be all right?
I have no problem with that.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dice.
I don't think I have a fiscal note here in my packet. Do you have another one, Celeste? Thank you.
Did you get it?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health and the Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health and Social Services. I'd like to comment just a little bit about the fiscal note that we have on Senate Bill 144 to provide the vaccines and replace some of the funding that we have been losing from the federal government, as was discussed on Monday. In coming up with the fiscal note, we looked at the recommended vaccines, both for infants, young children, kids through age 19, and also adult needs. We were sensitive. Vaccines are expensive now, as I commented the other day. To get all your vaccines by the time you're 2 years old, it's about $1,800 now. So they're pretty costly. We looked at it and tried to make decisions being prudent financially, trying to enhance the chances for success for the bill, I guess I would say, and looked at those vaccines that are the most cost-effective as far as the money spent. Overall, a dollar spent for vaccines, as I commented the other day, saves $8 and some in health care, $16 and some in time lost from work, and so on. So for the adults, there were the three vaccines in there, the flu vaccine, pneumococcal vaccine, and the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. It singularly does not have the shingles vaccine in. That's certainly a desirable thing to have, particularly for older adults, to prevent that, but it is rather costly. For the children and the infants, it has all the vaccines in that are required for a school entry, and a couple of others that are recommended, but there are three that are not in there. There's the rotavirus, which is a vaccine that helps prevent diarrhea in young kids and infants. There's the HPV for the human papillomavirus to reduce the incidence of that. Has been recommended for girls, now is being recommended for boys also. The Menactra, which is the vaccine that you get to prevent meningitis. It's particularly helpful for young people who are going to college, getting into those situations. and such. Those are expensive vaccines. The fiscal note came out at $2,900,000, and Jill will talk a little bit more about the details on that. But my understanding, as the bill's written, there is the flexibility there that, as depending on the availability of funds, we're not totally locked in. But if there is funding available, if we can be more efficient, if we can get more kids to get vaccines under the federally funded Vaccines for Children program. And, for example, my own take would be if we had more funds, I would want to see the rotavirus maybe be the first one that we would add back in there. But I think there's a flexibility there to look at what's recommended nationally and to make decisions on what we're going to give. It's a fairly complete array now of the ones that we felt were the most important, the most cost-effective, but I know that that question had come up. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
All right. Any questions from the committee at this point? Yes, Senator.
Just so it, those three vaccines we're talking about and listed in the fiscal note, those are not out of the question, correct?
At this point, they're not. But the program, they would not be there initially. In the future, right? I think we have flexibility going forward, where the commissioner has the flexibility to alter it. Vaccines will change. For example, the pneumococcal vaccine, the conjugate vaccine that we have now, is much more expensive, but it replaced an older vaccine. The science will change, and other vaccines will come along.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I did want to point out that Representative Miller has joined us from the House side.
Okay. You may continue.
Yes, through the chair, I think that's my understanding. Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Did anyone else have their hand? You said someone else was going to continue the discussion of the note, or are you done?
Jill Lewis, who's our, Madam Chair, the Deputy Director of the Division and is kind of our CFO, really has the financial details. I don't know if you need any more of that or not.
Madam Chair, maybe she's just there to make sure the Public Health Director keeps online.
Through the chair, that's a tough job.
And while we have this moment, I'd also like to say that Senator Morris has joined us.
Thank you.
Yes. I don't think we need any other information. This has one other referral. It goes to finance. The goals of the Health and Social Services Committee, I felt that we have met those, and that's why I asked that this bill be brought up again today so that we do not hold it up. Discussing the note. It can be discussed further in finance and any concerns or issues that you might have. The main goal of this Bill 144 is to reinstate the immunization program for the youth and for the adults, children and adults. That's what it will do. There is a sunset on it, 2015, that will give the administration and others time to work on having a long-term solution for us to provide the immunizations that we need to provide to our citizens of this state. And so even if money come in between that and we can do anything, what I think I hear you saying, that even though you might have those exceptions that you made, if the money became available, it could go into the budget at any given time. It does not have to wait to 2015. Is that not what you said?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be my understanding. We will continue to try to find other sources of funding. This targets the 25%, but if we are able to get more kids covered under the Vaccine for Children program, there would be funding available. Then the options would be either to turn it back to the state or to cover some of the vaccines that we would not be able to cover with this amount for the period that the bill is in existence.
All right, thank you. Any comments to be made by the Senate Committee on Senate Bill 144? And Senator Giesel, would you like to do some closing remarks on this, or are you ready for us to move along? Okay. All right. We do have other reports. And at this time, I'd like to entertain a motion for us to move the bill out of our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 144 to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal note dated 1/31/2012 and include individual recommendations.
Second.
And could I have a unanimous consent on that, or would we like to call the roll on this?
Move unanimous.
I hear no objection, then the bill so moved. We will sign the bill while we'll get it set up for the presenters to come forward. We're going to move right along now. We got Alaska Health Care Overview from the Health Commission. So we're going to call them up. I think they're all ready to go. And I'll turn it over to them.
Sick. What's wrong with you?
It's tickle in my throat.
I think you're sick. You're a sick man.
Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Erickson. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Healthcare Commission, and I'm joined back at the table by Dr. Hurlburt.
For the record, my name is Ward Hurlburt. I'm the designated chair of the Alaska Healthcare Commission, the director of public health, and chief medical officer of the Department of Health and Social Services.
So I'm going to spend a little time just hitting some highlights from the commission's 2011 report. All of the committee members should have a full copy of the bound report, as well as copies of these slides. I wanted to note that this is a long PowerPoint presentation. I wanted you all to be able to have more complete context and background information, but I'm going to be skipping over many of these slides just in the interest of time, and would be happy to follow up with any of you either answering questions at the end of the presentation or following up with your staff after the hearing. I'm going to skip over again a lot of the background information. I wanted to hit on this first slide about the increasing cost of health care in our state and the Commission's concerned about this long-term sustainability, even short-term at this point, sustainability of the health care system in our state. When we see the overall costs increasing to the extent that they have, just in the past 5 years, total spending for health care in our state has increased 40%, and it's projected to double again by the year 2020. One of the points that we've included in our report is just as a comparison to have some context understanding relative to other important sectors in our economy, a comparison to the value of oil output. And so for 2010, total health care spending relative to the value of oil output that year was about 50%. And with this, if we stay on the same cost trajectory based on Department of Revenue's projections for the value of oil that will be output in 2020, health care spending will be about 75% of that value. And again, it's just important to have some context to understand how healthcare spending is impacting our economy. It's not that it's impacting the value of oil, but it represents a transfer of wealth spending on healthcare. And there will be less resources available in the future to spend on those services. Related to affordability, we have some information on U.S. population, where we can see over the past 12 years, overall inflation has increased 38%, workers' earnings have increased 50%, while over that same time period, the cost of health insurance premiums have increased 160%, and workers' contributions to those premiums have increased 168%. And relative to those data, a recent study found that over the past decade, the healthcare cost growth has pretty much absorbed all of the income gains for the average American family. And in terms of affordability for Alaskans' families, some data from specific to prices for healthcare services in Anchorage, that over the past, since 1982, prices for medical services in Anchorage have increased 320%, while over that same time period, the CPI in Anchorage increased 95%. And so this is how it's falling out in terms of affordability for Alaskan employers who provide health benefits for their employees. Between 2003 and 2010, large employers, those are employers with 50 or more employees in Alaska, who offer insurance benefits for their employees, have decreased from 95 to 93%. For small employers, the percentage of those offering health benefits for their employees dropped from 35 to 30%. And just a real quick story so you have maybe a face behind these numbers. I get phone calls periodically from folks who have questions and concerns about their health care and health insurance. And one of the phone calls I received this past summer, earlier in the summer, was from a woman who was the phone call started off, she was very angry. She was angry at her husband's employer, and she went on to tell the story that she and her husband had just found out the previous month, to their delight, that she was pregnant with their first child. But she had just been informed that day that her husband, who works for a small aviation company in Anchorage, that they had just decided to discontinue providing insurance coverage for their employees effective the following month, because they couldn't afford the insurance premium increases that they were going to be hit with that coming year. So there are real people behind those numbers who are already being impacted in terms of their access to care and access to insurance. One of the things the commission will be spending more time talking about this coming year is what value we're getting for our health care dollar. We've been really focused on the cost of health care and prices for health care this past year, and I'll talk about that in a little more detail here in a second. But just to give you a sense with some data on outcomes, health outcomes, and quality of services relative to cost. For personal health expenditure, actually for total health spending, per capita health spending, Alaska has the highest per capita total health spending. Personal health expenditures were second in the nation behind Massachusetts, and we're about $9,100 per person for personal health expenditures, and Massachusetts spends about $150 more per person. But for that same cost, Massachusetts has covers 98% of their population, compared to our population, as many as 19 to 20% don't have third-party coverage. And Massachusetts is ranked by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. They do a measure on 100 different indicators on healthcare quality, and Massachusetts ranks fourth in the nation, where we rank 38th. And United Health Foundation ranks our state 35th in terms of overall health. And one important point I really wanted to emphasize is that one of the challenges in trying to dig in and understand problems better in the healthcare system is that it's hard to describe the problems and the challenges we face without it seeming as though we're trying to demonize the industry and the providers. We are not meaning to do that in any way, shape, or form. And we have many very high quality providers who have dedicated their lives to providing patient care, and every day spend their day focused on providing good quality care and safe care. But we know that all systems are perfectly designed to deliver the results that we get from them. And it's the way that our healthcare system is structured that is impacting whether we're really getting good value for the money we're spending or not. So what the commission is focused on doing is trying to come up with a series of solutions that will support transforming our system so that it works in a better way, so that's focused more on delivering good health outcomes at affordable costs, high quality, safe care. And our concern is that if we don't figure out how to control costs, we're going to have to cut care. And we're already seeing that play out in employers dropping insurance for their employees. Don Berwick's the recently departed CMS director. He was particularly concerned about Medicaid and Medicare, and that was his concern, figuring out how to cut costs so he wasn't faced with having to cut benefits and services. But this is one of the conundrums we face, is that cutting costs, just you can't cut costs in the healthcare system just by cutting costs. That because of the way the system is designed, the way services are incentivized, and the way cost shifting occurs, that if you make a cut in one area, it's like pushing in a balloon and it bulges out on the other end. Costs will just end up increasing in another area. And so what we're focused on is trying to figure out ways to make healthcare work better from the patient's perspective and the provider's perspective as well. So we've been working through a process where each year we spend a little time studying current problems in the system and also spend time studying solutions. And we have a vision of a future healthcare system that's going to be focused on delivering health and good health outcomes, as well as a system that provides high-value care that's sustainable and where both patients and the providers are satisfied with the system, where it's working well from both those perspectives. And part of our focus is on enhancing the consumer's role in health, both in their healthcare experience and making their healthcare more patient-centered and more innovative, and in the realm of prevention, how to support healthy lifestyles. So as I mentioned a minute ago, in terms of trying to understand challenges in our current system better, we commissioned two studies this past year during 2011. One was more of a macroeconomic analysis ICER conducted for us on healthcare spending and cost drivers in the state, looking at total spending by payer, by service type, and trends over time. We also contracted with an international healthcare actuarial consulting firm to come in and answer some questions about prices for healthcare services in our state. Something that in the past we described as kind of the elephant in the room, and payers would, commercial payers especially, would play the, I'll show you yours if you'll show me mine behind closed doors, not willing to share publicly the prices they were paying for services. And we thought it was important to start understanding better how prices for services in Alaska compare to some other states, and to have a public conversation about that as well. So we focused first on hospital and physician services, since those represent the greatest proportion of spending for healthcare services. And Milliman documented for us that our premiums here on average are about 30% higher than we selected a number of comparison states. You can see those in the report. And so the first step after breaking down, or identifying that we pay higher costs overall, was to compare, look at utilization and pricing. Total spending is a factor of use of services, the amount of resources, medical resources used, and the price for those services. And looking at utilization first, they found that Alaska, on average, is about the same. Their conclusions are that our utilization, Alaska's utilization, isn't a major driver behind higher premium rates relative to the other states. Just a little caveat about that, that doesn't mean that they're our solutions aren't focused on improving utilization. Most of our focus will be there. But in terms of that specific question, what's driving higher costs, the healthcare actuarials indicated that wasn't one of the issues. So then looking at the other factor, prices, they documented that physician services on average in Alaska for commercial insurance payers are 69% higher than the average of all the comparison states. And one of the things the commission wanted to focus on particularly, too, was the importance of understanding how those price variations differ between different specialties. So, for example, pediatricians in Alaska are paid 39% higher by commercial insurance payers compared to the average pediatricians in the other states. Cardiologists are paid on average twice as much in Alaska compared to the average of payment for commercial by commercial payers in the other states. For hospital services, our hospitals are paid on average 37% more by commercial payers than the average of private sector hospitals in the other states, and by Medicare 36% higher. But another important point to understand is the variation in reimbursement between different payers. And so for hospital services, our commercial insurance payers pay a little more than twice as much for the same service that Medicare will reimburse them. I've thrown in a few examples. You have real detailed spreadsheets in the report, in the appendix that includes Milliman's report. I just wanted to show you a few examples on comparing. This is a physician services, and it's specifically for specific procedures that the physician's providing. So, for example, on slide 25, the top row there, and each of these rows I highlighted in red the cell with the highest price and in green the cell with the lowest. And these are not just, this isn't the price charged, it's the amount actually allowed that's actually reimbursed. It includes the patient copay. And so this one example, the knee replacement, the average commercial allowed charge was $7,265. The lowest, North Dakota, the average insurance payment for that same procedure is a little over $2,000. And you can see how that varies between states. I also wanted to include a few examples of how the fees or the prices within Alaska paid for those exact same services vary between different payers. So the table that looks very much the same, but starting on slide 26 and 27, for that same procedure, you can see again the knee replacement, where the commercial insurance on average will reimburse a physician for that service at $7,200. Medicare will pay that same physician for that same service $1,900. And we included, we'd asked Milliman to also include the fee schedules for TRICARE, the VA, Medicaid, and workers' comp, and right down the line for every service that they analyzed for us, workers' comp fee schedule was higher than even the commercial insurance payers. So then, now that after looking at utilization, finding that was relatively the same, prices are higher, the next breakdown, trying to understand the drivers behind higher prices, they analyzed the operating cost, the cost to the provider delivering the service, and the operating margins, where they were able to identify that. And they did find that operating costs, of course, for our providers are higher here for a number of reasons. Just a couple of examples are higher medical salaries and cost of living. And the operating costs specifically, they were able to do a more detailed analysis of hospital data because of availability of public reports that they file with CMS, but that on average, all of our hospitals aggregated together, not just an average, 38% higher, but our rural hospitals are 86% higher, the cost of delivering services compared to the average of all hospitals. And they also found that physician discounts are lower in Alaska, which they explained as an indication that our physicians have greater pricing power in the healthcare market here. And so their conclusions were that for private hospital sector in Alaska, our prices are high relative to the comparison states, and that the operating costs are driving higher prices in rural Alaska. Operating margins are driving higher prices in urban Alaska. This is just generalized across all of the hospitals. It's not meant to be a financial analysis of individual services. For physician services, the prices are very high relative to the comparison states, and that those low discounts are indicative of higher pricing power. And another important point is that the low Medicare rates, which are below the cost to the provider of delivering the service create upward pressure on prices for other payers. So in terms of solutions, just real quickly, an important point that we try to pay attention to in the commission is that 5% of the U.S. population, this bears out even more so in some cases in Alaska, require 50% of all healthcare spending, while 50% of the population requires 3% of healthcare spending. And there's an opportunity there in understanding that we can focus resources on prevention, trying to keep those 50% who are already healthy from getting sick. But then looking at strategies for making the quality of care and the efficiency and effectiveness of care delivered to those folks who do need it, looking at strategies for improving care coordination and care management and other supports for those folks who are at the very tip of that pyramid. Actually, 1% of people require 20% of spending, and those are the folks with multiple chronic conditions, real complex situations. And if we can improve the efficiency and effectiveness of care, not only will the quality of their life be better, and their health, but it's going to save the overall system money in the long run. We had recommendations in 2010 related to the importance of evidence-based medicine, the fact that the research has documented that as much as 30% of spending for healthcare is waste, and bringing in strategies for making sure that decisions, both by individual patients and providers as well as by payers, are supporting the application of evidence-based medicine principles. Enhancing quality and efficiency of care at the front end, we've spent some time digging into learning more about patient-centered medical home model for improving primary care for patients. We studied three models from other states, three initiatives in other states this past year, Oregon, North Carolina, and Michigan, and identified the strategies that they had applied that they felt contributed to their success, and this was success in terms of saved money and decreased utilization of services by improving care early on. And also those attributes of the successful initiatives, availability of data, tools for the providers, those sorts of things. So there are a series of recommendations related to patient-centered medical homes. We also looked at the trauma system and support continued implementation of the American College of Surgeons recommendations. Another area the commission feels is real important to emphasize is the need for price and quality transparency following on this. Both for empowering the consumer and providers, and we hear from physicians that it's as much of a frustration to them as it is for consumers that they can't figure out how much a service costs because they feel responsible for their patients when they make a referral for a particular service. If they don't understand what sort of cost they're suggesting their patient incurs, that's a problem. We have some recommendations related to that and improving use of the hospital discharge database and studying the use of a development of an all-payer claims database in our state. Paying for value, we studied payment reform this past year, identified a number of attributes and capabilities that are going to be required for supporting moving the folks who pay for care as well as the providers towards being able to pay for services in a different way, so we're not paying for the individual services anymore but paying for outcomes. So there were a series of recommendations related to that, to payment reform and moving in that direction. The Commission had recommendations from our very first year in 2009 related to building the infrastructure to support a strong healthcare system around health information infrastructure and workforce development. And then as far as focusing on prevention, we learned about the significant public health challenge the state faces related to growing rates of obesity and overweight, and the medical spending that's incurred today for that, and also what we could look forward to in the future if we don't do something about that problem. So it's a recommendation related to implementation of programs to address that problem, immunizations, and ensuring funding and support for those programs, was a recommendation of the commission, and then also as far as a kind of a population health challenge in Alaska, looked at behavioral health and everything from substance abuse to depression and suicide and domestic violence, and have some recommendations related to breaking down the silos between behavioral health services and primary care, integrating those and supporting those with new payment methodologies, and also bringing in more screening using evidence-based tools in the healthcare setting. So we have a series of issues that we'll study next year and potential solutions. As far as solutions, one of the areas we want to focus on is understanding better the employer's role in health, both in supporting their employees to live healthier lifestyles and in redesigning health benefits so they're more supportive of health and driving value, just as one example. You can see the rest there on that slide and in the report. We've also included, while we're not directly addressing provisions in the Affordable Care Act, we're tracking that the implementation of the federal law. And in Appendix C of our report, just laid out in kind of a chart pack form, we have information on implementation in Alaska, the provisions that have taken effect so far. And so you have that available. If you have any questions, we would be happy to answer them.
Any questions will come in at this time? Members? This is a lot of material that you have here. And I know that we're probably going to have more questions and probably have to get back with you later. Is there anyone present that's here on the commission other than Representative Keller and your? There are others. I want to recognize you if you're here.
Yes, David Morgan, and I should have acknowledged too. Representative Keller is a representative from the House on the commission.
So, this is nothing new to you. You've been working on it for quite some time. There is that going to be the end of your presentation at this point, or are you just open now for questions or comments? I don't see a whole lot of hands being held up. Yes, Representative Millen.
You've been offering recommendations. Have you been tracking if we've been taking your recommendations and utilizing of the recommendations that you've presented? Which ones in the past years have we taken and have been successful in?
Well, one of the recommendations from 2009, the commission was just established in statute in 2010 and got started under the statutory charge just a year ago this past fall, but we first convened during 2009 under an administrative order by Governor Palin, and so during that year, one of the recommendations was that a permanent commission needed to be established and that we needed a law to do that. And so that's an example of one recommendation that was made early on that the legislature acted on. There are recommendations related to what is there anything in particular you wanted to highlight, Dr. Hurlburt?
I think of interest through the chair, Representative Millett, one of the recommendations related to more primary care. One of the differences in our country is that so few providers are primary care providers. And yet we spend 50% to 100% more than any other industrialized country in terms of percent of gross domestic product or in terms of dollars. One of the differences is they have more primary care providers. And it's the concept of the patient-centered medical home that Deb mentioned and that we read about and hear about. And so one of the recommendations early on from the first year of the commission before I came on board was to look at this concept. And with the commissioner's leadership and Kim Poppy Smart, the healthcare services division has led a contract to look at the patient medical dental home for Medicaid, which is a huge buyer of health services. So that's something that's happening around the country, but we are looking at it here in Alaska also to see what the value is. When we look at the other countries where there are more primary care physicians, where they spend less than we do, they live longer and their babies survive better than we do in this country here.
Thank you.
One question that I have, I see what your recommendations are. Do you have a dollar amount on the recommendations? Is there anything that's being requested in this budget?
Senator Davis,
carry some of this out?
We haven't made recommendations with specific dollar amounts attached to them. I think one of the balances we're trying to strike is to make general policy recommendations without getting too operational. So there are not dollar amounts associated with these individual recommendations.
And as I spoke with you earlier today, you had talked about an initiative that we passed a couple of years ago that Public Health was working on. I'd like for you to bring that forward for the benefit of the committee.
The employee wellness program?
Madam Chair. We have been concerned. As supervisors, as managers, we feel responsible for our employees. We're concerned about our employees. We're concerned about all state employees, and this is an issue that Senator Dyson has been very interested in over time, and I know others here that we have established an initial policy within the Division of Public Health with Commissioner Stewart's support related to what kind of foods we have, related to employee activity, trying to have a healthier lifestyle. And our vision, our hope is that as we implement that within public health, that it can be extended in the department and then extended statewide to really deal with our substantial workforce that we have as a state of America, to have healthier employees. It's prudent, responsible, enlightened management. It's also good business sense, because as you have healthier employees, they could be more productive. You have less illness, less absences, less expenses for employee health insurance coverage.
Thank you. That initiative came from this committee, and we know at this point there's not very much that's been done about it. You know, we've visited it from time to time at community councils and other places, but it's my understanding that you're starting this off in public health and that you hope to get other commissioners from the other administrative branches to come in and try to work a statewide plan for all state employees to follow. Is that not true?
Yes, Madam Chair, would be to start it in public health, to work it out, to extend it in the department. Could you look at it as an infectious disease, which would gradually spread through in a positive way? So.
Okay. We thank you for your information. I do see your hand. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For many, many years, legislators have asked in HES committees and other committees why in the world Alaskans pay so much higher costs for medical procedures here. Is there justification, or is it just what the market will bear in this relatively captive audience here of the Alaska population? And my understanding is that there was federal money available to our Division of Insurance, and they turned down the money or didn't apply for the money to answer that question. So the work that you all are doing is being done with just your state resources to figure that out, and I'm glad you're doing some work in that regard. Will the work be continuing, and what source of funding are you using for that investigation or examination?
Senator Ellis, through the chair. Yes, we are using our state resources. When the commission was established in statute, there was a fiscal note and state general fund dollars provided to support the work of the commission, and those were the resources used for the studies this past year and for any studies that we'll do into the future.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could just, and it may not be possible, but you may, if you haven't already done so, explore whether some of those federal monies that Division of Insurance turned down or did not apply for, I'm not sure which, if you could access those funds, if they're available to other states, and if they're available to your organization to use, that might help you dig deeper than what you would otherwise be able to do.
Any other comments? Hearing none, we do have another report to come before us, and want to take the time to thank you for coming forward. And I'm sure you'll be hearing from individual members, because it's a lot of material that we have here, and we'd like to follow through on what the recommendations are and where we might be able to help. Thank you very much, and we'll change 9, go to the Department of Health and Social Services. And have a seat. Who else is coming forward? You're doing all that work?
Ma'am.
Okay.
Nobody else would volunteer, ma'am.
Well, you could have twisted some arms and had them to come with you.
Come on in. Your guy is not low.
You want to state your name for the record, and we'll begin the overview.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Stewart, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and as I've said to several committees, I'm amazed every time I do say that title, but I'm still in it. Anyway, I'm going to give you a now briefer overview of the department and where we're going and pretty much who we are. We did one of these last year, and it elicited a fair amount of questions. But this one is going to be a little different because we need to change. We need to change the way we do things. We need to change the way we operate. We need to enlist our partners in this challenge. You'll see a slide here shortly that shows the growth of just Medicaid approaching in just a very few short years, $6 billion. That's with a B. This past year, if you've been reading nationally, the health care for the first time eclipsed $3 trillion in health care costs for the nation. That's big business. That's very big business. It's something that we need to begin to address. So the tone of my presentation today is going to be an overview, but also woven through it, the need for change and some of what we're doing to effect that change. A quick overview of the department and how we're laid out. Coming across the top right underneath my title, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Herbert, has already spoken to you today. He oversees public health and all the efforts within that particular division. Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid Healthcare Policy, Kim Poppy Smart, is in the back of the room. I'm not going to look back, see who's here, so if they're here, they'll have to raise their hands. But Kim oversees all of Medicaid. This past year, we went back to a traditional Medicaid model, consolidating Medicaid under one deputy. Previously, it was broken out. Two divisions were under a deputy, and the other division, the largest division, was under another deputy. And so all Medicaid services are consolidated under one individual. Senior disability services, behavioral health, and health care services, which is the general medical arm of health care that we provide. Medicare represents $1.6 billion of our $2.6 billion budget for 2013, and it is a significant effort. Then the support services for the department, public information, legislative liaison, and I know Wilda's here, at least she better be. health policy is an addition this year. Senator Meyer, in striving to help us, graciously offered up Josh Appleby. We told him about it afterward, but he did do that. And Josh has joined the team and has been a very meaningful part of dealing with all the health care changes that are out there and that the department is facing, whether it be the Affordable Care Act, whether it be attempting to look at Medicaid, whether it's health information technology. Josh is in the center of that particular part of it. Special assistant in my Anchorage office, Tara Horton, and the Alaska Healthcare Commission under Deb, which you've just heard the report on. Moving across to Ree Sailors, who's the Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services. Ree is in the back. Ree recently joined us from the National Governors Association and has hit the ground running and has taken on the very significant challenges of children's services, juvenile justice, and public assistance. And then finally, Assistant Commissioner Nancy Rolfson, who I gave a break from being here today. Nancy is overseeing our finance and our budget operations. Laura Baker has recently joined us again after a three-year hiatus trying out other departments, and she found out that she needed to come back home, and she's come back home to the department and is overseeing a larger part of our budget operation. Core services. I'm sure you're all familiar with missions and measures and the efforts under missions and measures that we are undertaking. I need to be honest, it has not been without pain, and will not be without pain as we continue to strive and continue to change and improve the way we do things. Core services are going to change. That's the only way I can say it. Doesn't mean that our efforts are not going to change, that our efforts are not going to move forward. It's just that we need to talk about partnerships, integration, and families. The core services include providing the highest quality of life in a safe environment for older Alaskans and veterans. It was just in the last 10 years the percentage of veterans in this state has increased exponentially. And whereas it's gone up 14% across the nation, it's gone up 70% in Alaska. 10 years since the last census, and it continues to grow. There's more and more of us entering that gray age, and some of us much younger entering the gray age, but it's going to be an increasing challenge for us and as we continue to move ahead. Manage an integrated and comprehensive behavioral health system based on sound policy, effective practice, and open partnership. That is one that I believe that we need to change, and we need to change that to manage an integrated and comprehensive health system, because we can't separate. Behavioral health is a part of everything that we do in healthcare and how we do it. Promote safe children and strong families. Manage healthcare coverage for Alaskans in need. One of the things that I say regrettably is that annually I spend $1.5 billion, and I don't know if it's the right care, the right time, the right place for the right people. And there needs to be a significant effort to get our arms around that, to drive care back to the primary care physician and primary care services, whether it be through our Native Health Partners or whether it be through our community health centers or our private practitioners. Hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior, promote the safety and restoration of victims and communities, and assist offenders and their families in developing skills to prevent crime. Provide self-sufficiency and basic living expenses to Alaskans in need. Promote and protect and promote the health of all Alaskans. Promote the independence of Alaska seniors and persons with physical and developmental disabilities, and provide quality administrative services in support of the mission. Our priorities, last year we had 5 priorities. And we consolidated those and made them more usable for what we're doing. Integrated health and wellness. And I'm going to just move through these as we go because I have examples of each. We have an adult preventive dental program. I would say it's more of an adult treatment dental program, because a lot of the expenditures that we have are for dentures, a significant portion, uppers, lowers, full plates, and such. It has changed the lives of people. I used this example before, being in a village and walking into a clinic, just as a gentleman was walking out with cotton all stuffed in his mouth, and he smiled at me as best he could, and I said, "Boy, I'd hate to see the other guy." And he literally stopped me and said, "I'm getting new teeth." And he was out in a village. And he says, "I'm going to be able to eat caribou again." And it didn't strike me until much later how significant an impact that is on that individual's life. We've heard other anecdotal examples of people receiving dentures and reentering employment because they can not cover their mouths. They can be open with people. And so it has had a tremendous effect. H1N1 pandemic influenza vaccinations and distribution to providers, we had a very effective method of addressing H1N1. You've just heard about SB 144 and the impact of vaccinations on individuals, and it's an ongoing program. And finally, the efforts we've already undertaken with childhood obesity and the programs that we've done. You're going to hear a lot about obesity from us this year. Dr. Herbert very aptly describes it as probably the greatest challenge that we have in healthcare, and this generation may be the first generation to not live as long as their parents. Healthcare Access and Delivery, the Medicaid Task Force. You know, as much as you may have heard about all the challenges that we have with it, the Medicaid Task Force has grown legs. And through the series of reports that are coming up and other times, you're going to see the effects that we're already seeing with what we've implemented in the Medicaid Task Force. Patient-centered medical homes is going to be the core of what we do. And once again, this is driving care back down to the primary care level where it should all begin. Pharmacy, effective use of generic and formula medicine. We've already saved millions. One of the programs is saving $500,000 per month. And we do not believe that we are seeing any diminution of the quality of health care that we're providing under that. And Community First Choice, one of the programs that we have to deal with the many challenges that we have with our waiver populations. Sustainable long-term care delivery system. I've already talked about seniors. I am one now, so I can say that I have a bias there. Some of you would say I've been one for a while, but it is a pervasive challenge that we're going to be facing, because growing old is not cheap. It's not cheap for us who are growing old, and it's not cheap for those that have to provide the support for us as we do so. Alaska seniors and veterans in the Pioneer Homes, we had significant challenges in the Pioneer Homes in terms of waiting lists, in terms of services that are available, and an aging population. The average age in our Pioneer Homes is 86, and every time I say that, I'm amazed at what a valuable, huge resource that is for the citizens of Alaska. And we need to figure out ways that we're going to continue that moving forward. Is there a better way to do it? Is there a more effective way to do it? Can we grow it without pricing ourselves completely out of an ability to provide those services? So it's going to be a challenge going forward. But, you know, I have to say that the Pioneer Homes, and I think Dave Cody is still here, he hasn't walked out on me yet, have done a wonderful job in being a resource to the citizens of the state of Alaska. We serve 30,000 recipients through senior and disability services, largely in the waiver programs. Waiver programs are an optional service in Medicaid. And as people say to me, well, we need to eliminate the optional services. The impact of that would be devastating. We need to figure out ways to do it smarter. There's no doubt about that. But reducing that resource is significant. Partnering with Native organizations for nursing home care. Last October, we opened our first Native nursing home that developed in cooperation with a Native organization at Kotzebue. It's an 18-bed facility attached on to the end of that beautiful hospital, and it is just a wonderful facility. And I believe there's 16 in there as of yesterday, so that's significant. We have efforts going on in Nome. We have efforts going on in Bethel. And there's rumors that others are coming to visit us this year. So stay tuned on that when you will probably be visited. Safe and responsible families and communities. One of the themes I want to have in the department and want to hopefully drive down to everything we do is a focus on families. Whether it doesn't matter what that family is, but we got to take care of our kids. And developing safe home environments for them has to be a cardinal part of what we do. OCS may have one of the toughest jobs out there. I was a protective service worker, child protective services worker for 6 weeks. And before I found another job, I was a fighter pilot, and it didn't scare me as much as that did. So it is significant, and what they do is significant. And you know, we hear about all the challenges that they have, whether it be with a child, with a family, replacing a child in a home. But we seldom hear about all the good that they do, and there's a tremendous amount of good that they do, as well as the Division of Juvenile Justice dealing with some very great challenges in reintegrating these kids back into their home societies. Child advocacy centers, co-locating those with our Office of Children's Services office is significant. And Families First, which is a program in the Division of Public Assistance, oriented toward when a family comes through the door, let's look at all their needs. Let's not just look at the need and hope that they may or may not come back for additional services that they may need. Safe and responsible families and communities continued. I've already talked a bit about juvenile justice. Heating assistance grants, over 14,500 grants during the 2010-2011 heating system. That's a lot of folks we touched. This year we're on a pace to be at about the same level. You know, it's been a tough winter already. So hopefully we can continue to expedite payments and expedite getting the services out to them. We don't know what's going to happen in the next few years with federal funding for this program, you know, we're going to do what we can as long as we can do it. And finally, home and community-based senior and disability services. I don't think there's a person in here who doesn't agree with me that the closer we are to home, the better our lives are. And so we need to continue to focus on that. Medicaid, I promise you a slide, a shock slide. This is it. Medicaid right now is around $1.6 billion, 2030. It's going to be in excess of $5 billion. That's the total bill to the state. But we're at 50%, so take half of that $6 billion, and that ends up being the bill to the state. And frankly, with the wellhead value and everything, all these neat numbers that you hear from Department of Revenue, this doesn't pencil out well to being able to continue to sustain the same way we're doing things. And I think we have lots of opportunity to address this. But the only way we can do that is through our partnerships and working with others. This slide is just kind of a overlay busy graph of where we spend most of our money. And as you can see, the 800-pound gorilla is Medicaid services at $1.645 billion. Goals. I'm going to skip through these because I've already pretty covered much of this. I want to talk a little bit about our facilities and what we have, or the services and what we have, and so that we can continue to be on schedule and we open up for questions. Pioneer Homes. If you haven't visited a Pioneer Home, you need to. I was recently at Matsu Services Grand Opening, and I walked around the corner to the Pioneer Home, and they were having their Oktoberfest party. And went inside, and to the tune of the Oompa band playing, I thought, where am I? Right back in Germany again. And they were having bratwurst and kraut and potato salad, German potato salad. They were, I mean, the full meal deal. They had all kinds of different mustards out and everything else. Lots of non-alcoholic beer floating around the facility, and a couple of them had real beer because they could. But it was a home. It is a home. And, you know, whether I visit Fairbanks, whether I visit Anchorage, whether I visit Juneau, it's a home to these folks. And, they walked me back to the room, they wheeled me back to the room, or I wheeled them back to their room. I wasn't in a wheelchair. I didn't try one out. They were proud of where they lived, and they were proud of what they had. So it is an invaluable resource to us in what we do. Division of Behavioral Health. If Melissa were here, she would tell you that she has huge challenges. Behavioral health continues to be one of our fastest-growing lines of business. But when you look at the range of services that are delivered under behavioral health, just starting with substance abuse and all the challenges that we have with substance abuse, and try to find one of our social problems that we have that isn't related in some way to substance abuse or of our health issues that woven through everything that we do. Many, many of our challenges in health are related to that. But our mental health services, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute is a part of that. For a long time, it was full. It will be full again. But it's going to be an area that you're going to hear more about from Melissa, but it's something that we need to continue to have in our sights, if you will. Office of Children's Services, I spoke about that. It's tough. Representative Keller spoke earlier about a public hearing that we had that wasn't supposed to be a public hearing, but I won't ask him to go into that. A public hearing that we had where we were both caught and that it ended up on the radio. As we were driving up, we found out about it. And instead of having four or five families there, we had almost 100, I believe, people that showed up for this thing. And
one guy that wanted to beat me up in the parking lot.
Luckily, we had Senator Dyson there to be the bouncer. So, but it was a great turnout. The stage was set by Representative Keller that, you know, this was an opportunity to talk about solutions rather than problems. And for the most part, it was a very organized and well-represented discussion of challenges that we have with providing effective children's services. There were some mighty sad stories, but there were some mighty good solutions that came out of that. Christy Lawton, whom you will meet if you haven't met already, Christy's not afraid to get in front of people, and she's also not afraid to say we're wrong and we can fix this. It's a work in progress. It probably always will be a work in progress. Because when you're dealing with the issue of kids and the sensitivity of dealing with kids and the importance of dealing with kids, you can't not be emotional about it. Division of Healthcare Services, this is the 800-pound gorilla. Kim Poppy Smart is also shown as the director of this. She's deputy commissioner. She's multiple jobs. She multitasks. This is the lion's share. This is of Medicaid. This is where all the claims are paid, all the utilization review studies are done. It's a large part of the direct interaction with providers and work with providers. Tough job, tough task. The MMIS system, you've heard about me talking about this for years upon years. I know that continues to be under development. We're hoping to bring up particular components of it over the next few months as we begin to move forward to full implementation sometime after the first of the year. The new MMIS system will be highly capable. We will be able to do the things that we should have been able to do 10 years ago, but when it's a 27-year-old COBOL non-relational system, you don't do a whole lot with that system without great pain. Division of Juvenile Justice. DJJ facilities are spread throughout Alaska. I would name them, but I would miss some. Barb struggled through it the other day. Barb Benjamin is the director. She struggled through it the other day and barely got all six of them. Some would call them jails. I would call them safe havens for kids. The kids that are in there, some of them, they're tough. And but we've saved a lot of them, and we need to continue to save them. She's got stories about some of the stuff that we've done. We've stretched in the way we serve some of these kids. We took kids out of one of the facilities and took them caribou hunting this year. And the first time they told me that they're going to take them caribou hunting, is you're putting guns in their hands. And, but. It was a very effective program. It worked well. It's an excellent service from what we provide. It's just how much more can we grow it? Division of Public Assistance, Ron Creer. Ron's the director of this program. It's where all our food stamps, public assistance, Medicaid enrollment. It's the gateway, if you will, to the array of services that the department provides. To the individual. The LIHEAP program, the heating assistance program, is a part of this. Division of Public Health, that's all our public health nursing. It's our maternal and child health. It's our epidemiologists. It's the full array of services, public health services that we provide to Alaskans. So much good comes out of there. This is probably the division that we interact most with other departments on. Everything from dealing with the effects of coal mines up north a little bit to public health emergencies to disaster response is located within this division. And it keeps Ward Hurlburt young. Some people would say it's making him older, but it's keeping him young and happy and smiling. Senior Disability Services, our other fast-growing division, is going to continue to be a fast-growing division. One of the things that I think that we need to continue to do here is enhance our services that we provide. And I don't mean grow our services. I mean enhance our services in terms of let's make sure that it is the right care, the right time, the right place, the right people, because we have growing services, whether it be our PCA services, whether it be our four waiver programs, they seem to be going up and up and up. Some of you may be heard from constituents. If you didn't, you missed out. We issued a set of regs that weren't very popular. A month or so ago, Senator Egan is shaking his head because he was one of the recipients of almost as many letters as I got. And we wisely pulled those back, not because they're bad regulations, but because they're misunderstood regulations. Shame on us that we didn't do a better job people understand the impact. Because, you know, when you reduce services, you know, there needs to be an alternative presented. The alternative was there. It wasn't presented. And so we're going to refine those regulations, make them more clear, make them more understandable, and we'll come back out with them again. Financial Management Services, that's my budget shop. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it, but it's where it all begins each year. The overriding theme for future direction of the health, the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, helping individuals and families create safe and healthy communities. They're our partners. Families are our partners. Our tribal healthcare delivery systems are our partners. It is all about partnerships and moving forward. With that, Madam Chair, that is a quick overview and under the timeline, and looks like everyone is still awake. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Yes, Dr. Senator. Senator Dyson.
I apologize for my comment earlier. This gentleman, I'm the head of his fan club, and but he's not been being a good example of health care. He's been working in it arguably 100 or 80-some hours a week, and the lights are on in his office 16, 17 hours a day. He's not been sleeping and so on. But, sure, you commit an almost unpardonable sin in forgetting the Chugiak Senior Center, arguably one of the better. But just in general, would you comment about what's going on with benefit fraud, particularly in the medical area in the nation, and what you think it might be like here, and what, if anything, we should be doing?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, benefit fraud nationally has become a part of major crime, and that in Florida, it's a part of the syndicate down there, and in New York City, they recently broke up a ring of where they billed something like $300 million and with false recipient names, false recipient IDs, and were able to get away with it for a short while before it got discovered. And when the investigators from the New York Department of State Health went to visit this particular pharmacy, it had been shut down for 3 months, and it was just a shell. Where somebody came and picked up literally boxes of checks every day. It is very much a part of healthcare, as regrettably as it may sound. I actually believe in Alaska. It is significant less than that, but it's anecdotal for me, and we need to continue to develop our efforts around utilization review, around fraud and abuse, our billing structures, and follow up on those. The new MMIS system, the Medicaid Management Information System, the claims payment system, will have many more built-in capabilities to detect fraud. But I think one of the things we need to do is start benchmarking our providers. And benchmarking, basically, it looks at billing patterns of providers and looks at outliers. And it's not really benchmarking the quality of what they do. It's benchmarking the quantity of what they do. Are they upcoding In other words, are they charging for a higher level of care than they should be charging for the individuals? And we are stepping up efforts in that, and we'll continue to do that, sir.
Yes, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here today. And I appreciate the department pulling back the regs on the senior services to give some more thought to that. But there's some other regs out there that are of concern. I know we've talked before, and you appreciate the importance of medical and social detox. And, you know, there's a panic in Fairbanks and in Anchorage with the detox services because someone at the department has put out regs for review, or I don't know how far we are in the process, actually, that require a higher level of nursing services on every shift. And, of course, it's very hard for the detox programs, the Salvation Army in particular in Anchorage, nurses are hard to come by and very expensive, difficult to recruit and retain in the marketplace. And that's why Salvation Army shut down several years ago, and we had to all work together to bring it back. Because, in my community, or all communities, it's life and death. And in Anchorage, we had 14 people just drop dead in the parks and on the streets and, from the lifestyle of chronic inebriation. Can I just ask you to give some personal time to those regs that are causing a real problem for detox programs in the state?
Senator Ellis, through the chair, yes, we are continuing to look at that. It's kind of a mixed bag for me. First 14 years of my checkup past in healthcare were dedicated to drug and alcohol treatment. And so I ran a detox center as part of what I did. And the checkered part of the challenge that we have with it is that detox is not child's play. It is a very serious medical procedure, and it needs to be done correctly. So we want to make sure that effective care is there so that when the people present, we can take care of them. Social detox can work done correctly, and we are taking a look at those regs, and we'll amend as we can.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? One more?
Yes, if no one else is taking a turn. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, there was federal money available for all the states across the country to develop their own health exchanges to comply with the federal law, and great leeway with states to develop, what was right for them. And, of course, we think of ourselves as very unique and different here in the last frontier. Instead, the administration, you all chose to not use the federal money but to use state resources, if I understand correctly. Can you give us a ballpark figure on what has been the cost in terms of state dollars for the development that you're in on a state exchange, and how much do you project or expect to spend on developing a health exchange for the citizens of Alaska? And maybe an update on how far along you are and how it's going.
Senator Ellis, through the chair, I can do that very quickly. First of all, the money that we spent to date is incremental in that it has been largely Josh Appleby's salary. We have just now enlisted the consultant. That's up to a $300,000 maximum contract for them to develop it. I am hoping that it is as simple a process as I can make it. We are also trying to identify the population that we have involved in this. With the Medicaid expansion that will occur on January 1, 2014, where every man, woman, and child under 138% of poverty level will be eligible for Medicaid, that cuts 35,000 off an estimated 100,000 of uninsured. Carve off those that won't buy insurance come heck or high water, that's probably another 25%. So, we have a finite population that may be eligible for this thing. So the range of the cost of exchanges in states that have already brought up the exchanges at the low end is Utah at $500,000. At the high end is Massachusetts at $30 million. So lots in between. The state of Washington, I believe, is coming in at around $26 million. And incrementally, there's some $55, $60 million projected under the those that took the funding under the Affordable Care Act. I don't know what ours is going to cost. I'm hoping to make it as electronic and virtual as we possibly can. If we are able to realize a new EIS eligibility information system, enrollment system for public assistance, that could theoretically function as our exchange, because it does exactly what exchange does. It looks at a person's resources and it determines their eligibility for services. And you can stratify that. You can stratify it for those that are eligible for public assistance services or Medicaid services. You can stratify it for those that require premium assistance, and the third level stratified for those that qualify for insurance. And then having a linkage to the broker community to function as brokers to help the individuals seeking insurance or to process and assist those with premium assistance could be a reality for that. And that's why we've engaged a consultant, because I think Alaska is unique in that respect, is that we have a relatively small insurable population that will seek this. We have a high level of self-insured in this state, higher than many states. The oil companies, for the largest part, are self-insured. Providence is, Regional is. State of Alaska is, the university is. So I don't know what the opportunity is going to be. I don't know what the exposure is going to be, but Josh is going to be working very closely with the contractor to attempt to determine those things. In terms of timeline, the contractor is on board. By March 30th, we'll have our first report from them on where we are going and what we're doing. And potentially, if it's a go-ahead, we could be putting out an RFP by June or July to solicit a vendor. And we'd be ready to put something before the legislature, potentially, you know, depending on how the Supreme Court ruling works for the Affordable Care Act and whether or not all of this or any of this goes forward, we'd be able to address that at that time. I will have an interim report that I will be able to provide probably early summer.
Okay, well, that's good to know. You want to follow any more? The other question that I would have pertaining to that, there is a bill that's out there here on the Senate side to establish an exchange. Or could you say if the administration is looking at that particular model that's presented in that bill, or would you compare what it might cost to implement that versus what the recommendations might come to you from the vendor, that the person that you hired to do the consulting?
Madam Chair, the administration is not looking at that bill. We believe that the bill in its present form is more than we need for the state of Alaska, and that we need to have more from our consultant to help us determine the extent of what our need really is, and that we are more comfortable with pursuing that direction than that under the bill.
Thank you. We're right at the closing time for the committee, and I want to thank the House side for coming over to join us for the reports that we had. And at this moment, if you don't have any other comments, we will adjourn at 3 o'clock.